Accession number 18022, Reel 3.
Ken Black, Reel 3.
Yeah. So the guy came out to the open the door at the end of the carriage, threw a bucket of water out as I'm stood running, trying to run up after the train, shouting and waving my arms about. He just closed the door and went in. And the train disappeared round the bend. And I thought, God, what am I going to do? I couldn't speak the language. I didn't know where I was. I had no maps. I had 9 rounds of 38 ammunition. And I thought, I've got to do something. So I thought, the only thing I can do is walk up the railway tracks till I come to some kind of civilization and beg, borrow, steal a vehicle and then get up to the next station before the train came in. So I decided to plod up on the tracks and that, and I saw this tunnel and I thought, oh God, I'm not going through a tunnel. So I climbed up the hillside and they told us about guerrillas being in the hills and that. And I'd got halfway across the tunnel. I didn't know how long it was, but I must have, I got part way anyway, I won't say halfway. And I heard these shots, and I ran like hell. I got to the far end of the tunnel, and I just set off and rolled down the hillside. And I thought, well, at least they can't shoot me while I'm rolling. Anyway, I couldn't see anybody, and the shots finished. There were no noise, no nothing, so I thought, if I keep going north, eventually I'll find something. Anyway, so going up north, walking up the, you know, the railway track, I heard a train whistle. And this may sound stupid, but honestly, it is true. I stood in the middle of the track, waving this 38, and I thought, I'll shoot the train if it doesn't stop. Anyway, it came on, did the train, and it slowed down. And they're all saying, come on, get on, you stupid bastard, where you been? And what it was, the guy had gone in the railway carriage and he said, I just seen one of our blokes walking up the track. So they had a quick call, you know, who's here and who's there. He says, oh, it's that bloody Black again. And so as the train had gone through the tunnel, and as I were walking halfway, they were firing shots over the top of the train to get the driver to stop, to reverse back down the track. And as I'd gone that way, they'd gone that way. And then, of course, we met like. And I didn't half get a bollocking off Sergeant Major Valance. God, he called me all sorts of stupid names and one thing and another. And the rotten sod had ate me breakfast. Didn't save me no breakfast. And that's my first, shall we say, adventure in South Korea. Everybody thought it were great. You know, they laughed about that for ages and ages. Yeah, I was the only one fell off the train. And then as we got further up and further up, we got up to, as we were going up into North Korea, the Yanks were coming back out again. And different squadrons were on different trains, different places. I believe they managed to stop a squadron and turn them back. Because at that time, the Chinese had intervened. And the Americans were doing a bunk down south. A big bug out, they called it. We arrived at a railway station in Busan. And there were no... Pyongyang. And there were no facilities for offloading, so they just turned the tanks on the flat cars and drove them straight off and that. And everything were being burned, blown up, and food, supplies, clothing, all the Americans were blowing it up. We'd been issued, before we went to Korea, with ski boots that were supposed to have been made for... the British that were going to go to Finland sometime in the, I don't know, just after the First World War or something. And they'd given us these boots and they were covered in grease. And they says, clean them up and wear them, you know, to get your feet used to, which we did. And we hadn't been in Korea all that long. And the soles started falling off. And at that time, we got boots off the Americans. But while they were blowing and burning the supply dumps at Pusan, we got some beautiful American clothing to wear. Gabardine suits, fur-lined gabardine suits, like trench coats, these fur-piled caps and that, jackets, socks, trousers, shirts, a lot. They weren't very happy about us wearing American gear. Later on, it got that so much American gear was being worn that they allowed you to wear it. The clothing that had been issued when we went out was not very brilliant for the winter. It was string vests and woolly pullies and your normal battle dress trousers and long johns. And you wore those and your shirt and your battle dress and your tank suit on top of that, and you felt like Michelin Man walking up and down. And we lost touch with the regiment when they turned to come back down south. The Churchills were very, very slow vehicles and that, and somehow we got separated, and we spent quite a long time making our own way back down into South Korea, which we did eventually, but we did it by his own methods. There were nobody to say, you know, there were four of us on the crew, and there were nobody else to say, oh well, you've got to do this and do that. The only thing we knew was to make his way down south, which we did to the best of our ability, and we managed to get ourselves on one of the last flat cars to leave to go down south, or otherwise I don't know what would have happened. You know, we were just like left on our own, and that. It sounds silly and that, but if you're on a battle tank, well, that's okay, because you're in a troop, part of a squadron, and, you know, they move up and down together as troops or squadrons or things like that, and, shall we say, somebody seems to care for you and that, whereas on recovery, you know, you're on your tod-like, which we found ourselves quite frequently on our own like that. Some airy times, an odd couple of times, just being on your own. But, you know, you made it through. As I say, I spent all my time on recovery, which wasn't a very nice job. If you imagine the paddy fields were obviously all over, and they had banks in between, you know, to keep them separated. And the only fertilizer they had in Korea was human fertilizer, which they used to mix up with water and spread on the paddy fields. And you get a tank driving through the paddy fields, and you had good drivers, bad drivers. Some were forever shedding tracks. And if they shedded a track in the paddy field, we had to come with the recovery and bring them out, not only bring them out, but put the track back on. And if you can imagine walking in a couple of foot of mud, trying to break tracks so you could pull it out, and then pull the track out and put it back on again, it was a very, very physical job. And at times, not only was it physical, it was dangerous by the fact we were being shot at and mortared. You know, there were some quite spectacular times, if you like to call them that. Other times we'd probably go 48 hours with very little sleep, because as fast as you recovered one, somebody else would shed a track. So you had to go out, you would probably be down in the next paddy, and you would have to go back up to him and that. And we hadn't actually been trained for it. you learned it on the job kind of thing. And everything was big and clumsy. You couldn't just put a single... Inside the Churchill, instead of being a main armament, there was a winch. I don't know, it had about an inch and a quarter diameter rope in. A steel rope. And you pull this out and you could fasten it various ways to the tanks to, you know, to pull them out. If you just put a single rope out and pulled it, it would probably snap it. But you had these things called snatch blocks, which you could fasten on with a shackle and put the rope out and bring it back to the ARV. So that allowed you to pull a bigger tonnage. And if you put another snatch block on the your own ARV, you could bring it out three or four times, which increased the tonnage of pull. We only put a single rope out ever once to pull this guy out, and we thought we could pull it on a single rope, and the rope snapped. And if you've never seen a steel rope snap, it's like a whiplash, goes like a snake. Nobody were hurt, but we had to have a new rope after that. Tremendous. The speed it goes. You could actually see it starting to, you know, the strands starting to snap and uncurl. And then everybody took off on that. It cracked and bust. If you were on recovery, you pulled everything out. From jeeps to armoured cars, tanks. We've pulled American weasels out. Canadian bulldozer, we've pulled them out. Because the Canadians had Shermans, but they had a Sherman recovery vehicle, but we were the nearest to the bulldozer, so we pulled him out. We once stayed one night with this Canadian, once again it was a bulldozer, and we'd got a little far away from everybody else. So we decided it was decided for us we would stay where we were for the night and then move back again in the morning. So we called in and said, can we shut radio down, keep, you know, conserve batteries? And they said, yeah, okay. And there were three of us on the recovery, the ARV, and there were two on the Canadian bulldozer. So we made an L and put all the sleeping bags in a row. And the Churchill had escape hatches at side, or doors you could get in between the tracks and that. And we used to always leave a door open at night. And we'd had something to eat and shut everything down and decided to bed down for the night. And whether or not the Chinese not knew we were there, I don't know. But we had that shit mortared out of us for about 10 minutes. And then all of a sudden it stopped. And after the first couple of mortars dropped, the five of us stuffed ourselves in the driving seat and the co-driver's seat for two. And there were five of us all stuffed in there and that. And then the mortaring finished. And that was it. So the sleeping bags were covered in all sorts of stuff that had been blown up. And we never... As stupid as it sounds, we never even put a guard out that night. We just all got back in sleeping bags and all went to sleep. And next morning, there was a stream not far away, so we went down to get some water to make some tea. And in the mud of the stream, a Chinese patrol had come through, and you could see their footprints in, because they wore a shoe that were, it had, you know, like for the big toe, and the others were separate. And you could see all these that had come down. And they'd had mules with them, because they were all the prints. And I'm convinced today that if we'd have had a guard on, you would have been coughing and spitting and, you know, making some kind of a noise. And they would have known we were there. But we never knew they were there. And obviously they never knew we were there. From time to time, they were... Two or three things like that. You know, afterwards you think, God, what a stupid set of bloody people we were. But we were lucky. Yeah, you know, we were lucky. another time we were going to pick her. The Centurion had broke down with two 45-gallon drums of petrol on the back with the crew, and we were going up to recover it, and all the hydraulics went dead in the ARV, and it set off rolling back down a hill. And I've never been in a tank that moved as fast as that. There was nothing you could do to stop it. And a lot of them bailed out, and I thought, well, I'm stopping in. So I stopped in the turret, put the hatch down, and at the bottom of the hill was some Australian 25-pounders, you know, in a firing position. And they ran like hell because they thought it were going to hit them. And one track hit a big rock, and it slewed it round, and it stopped it. And as I say, I've never been in a tank that went as fast as that. With quite a few different things like that. Because we went up Korea and down Korea and up and down again, as it fluctuated. Now, we came back down south, and then we went back up again, and then we came back again, and we went part way up. And but all the time that this was going on, recovery was on call. Like, you know, it didn't matter who it was. There was a squadron of crocodile flamethrowers with the 7th RTR. I don't know if it was C Squadron. Now, they all had Churchills, and their recovery was a Churchill recovery vehicle. And, you know, they had the same, I believe, same thing. You know, if you were there and somebody bogged down or broke down, you went and pulled them out. And we once went into Tegear workshops for a new gearbox, and while we were in the workshops, some of the Remy guys said, "Can we have a look inside?" And we said, yeah, you know, go and have a look inside. And we were sat round an oil drum that we were burning some wood in to keep warm, and one of the guys came out with a very pistol, and he says, "What's this?" You know, because it's a funny looking thing, is a very pistol. It's like an old fashioned blunderbuss, and put a big cartridge in. So he said, "Oh, it's for shooting cartridges out, flares and that." He said, "Have you got any?" He said, Yeah. So he told him where. So he broke it open and put one in, and we're all sat round passing this, saying, "Go on, fire it, you fire it." And when it came to me, I just pointed it up in air and fired it, and it sent this red flare up in air. And half a Tegear turned out, did police out, did all units turned out, and nobody split on me. I could have been in serious trouble. We didn't get on very well with the battery. The company sergeant major in the school, in the Remy workshops, and they gave us all their guard duties to do while we were there, and we weren't very happy about doing their guard duties. So we didn't get on very well with him. Anyway, when they decided, when we got the new gearbox in, they said, "Right, tomorrow you're on the transporter and you're back up like." So Ania, my mate, the guy that lives in Wales now, we decided to go into their cookhouse and break into their cookhouse, and we stole 36 dozen eggs, and we put it on the back of the ARV, all in one big crate, put it back on the ARV and covered it up with a tarpaulin and strapped it down, got on the back of the transporter, and on the way up there was a New Zealand artillery coming back, so the transporter drew onto this side to let them go by, and the roads in Korea were very umpty-dumpty, and he'd got on a soft shoulder, and so eventually it creaked and creaked, and it flipped up and it fell over, and it was the edge of a minefield that it fell into, and it never set anything off, and we recovered it ourselves with the winch off the Diamond T, and with the petrol and oil and water back in it, we drove it back up again. But all our eggs were bust, and that's what we were bothered about, because we'd had visions of 36 dozen eggs between three of us. We were going to have eggs for breakfast, eggs for dinner, and eggs for tea, and we ended up with about three or four of them. All the rest were smashed to bits on that. So,
what's a Diamond T?
A tank transporter. And another time, we broke down outside an American engineer camp, and it must have been winter time, part of winter time, because it was snowing. And they came out of this camp to see what we were doing, and we said, "Oh, we broke down. We've got to stay. We're staying here like till the." To send something up for us, or, you know, spare parts and that. And they said, "Come in our camp." I said, no. I said, "We can't. Sort of got to look after this." Because believe it or not, you signed for the vehicle and all the equipment that went on. And if you lost it, you were responsible for it. Anyway, some fairly high-ranking American officer came out and, you know, wanted to know what it was, and we told him it was a recovery vehicle and all the story and that. And he said, "Well, where are you going to sleep?" And we said, "Sleep here, like." I said, "It's got sleeping bags and that." He said, "You're not going to sleep on floor." I said, yeah, of course you sleep on floor. And he said, "Same, come in, you know, come and stay with us." And we said, "No." So he explained to him about, you know, sign for, and he put a guard on for us and said, "You know, I'll put a guard on, you come in." And we had 2 days there with these Americans. Brilliant. We slept in cots, with sheets, with showers, cinema shows. You went in for a meal, on these trays with certain compartments and that. You could have as many fried eggs as you want, scrambled eggs, bacon, how did you want it cooked? How did you want your eggs cooked? 20 cigarettes every day, handful of chocolate bars and one thing or another, all laid out on your bed. Brilliant. Well, with 2 days, we weren't very pleased about leaving that. But eventually the spares came up, and because one of the crew, when there were four of us, Tom Fletcher, the original crew was Tom Fletcher. He was the driver. I was the operator and General Dog's body, with Sergeant Thaddeus Douglas was the commander, and we call it Tiger Annie was the vehicle mech. They were in the Remy and we were in the 8th Hussars. And so that whatever, if it were a thing like changing plugs and things like that, that, you know, he could do easily, Sergeant Douglas and Annie did that side of it, and Fletcher and I used to look after the tracks and, you know, various things like that. And then, of course, everybody shared in with the cooking. I mean, we only had each crew was issued with a small petrol stove and a big Dixie to go on it with a lid, and that did for you cooked with that for the crew, you know, the four of you. Fletcher was a reservist. Fortunately for us, he'd been in the Second World War in Africa, a lot of his time in Africa, and he showed us methods of cooking, you know, quick methods of cooking. I mean, fill in a tin of sand and that, fill it full of petrol, throw a match in, and you could put something on there. Then he showed us, when we were in the Remy workshops, he told the Remy guys about making this thing, and they called it a Benghazi. He called it a Benghazi. And it was two shell cases put inside one another and braced to keep them waterproof, and a little hole cut out at the bottom. And he put an empty tin underneath, a margarine tin, a small bean tin. You fill it full of petrol, you fill the outside full of water, and you threw a match at it, and it worked on the principle of a blast furnace, and it roared up, especially if there were a wind, and he had about 3 pints of water boiling in next to no time, which were brilliant because instead of having to use the cooker to do water for your tea, you had a choice. You either did your tea first and your meal after, but with this Benghazi you could do tea in there and while you were cooking at the same time. We were on compo rations at first, British compo rations, which didn't vary a great deal. It was either corned beef in one, they were A, B and C. Either corned beef, stewing steak, steak and kidney pudding. And that was the choice. And I think you got a choice of sweet. But later on we went on to American rations, which was some of the C rations. And you got one man's rations in a pack for a day. And they were brilliant. They had different menus. And there was everything in, there were toilet paper, there were cigarettes, there were 20 cigarettes in, there was like a big jelly block, like a big round trees pastel, there were what they call sweet cookies, you know, like cream biscuits and crackers and that, and then you had the sachets of coffee and powdered milk, and they were brilliant, rations were brilliant. If you got a hold of the big 10 men's, American 10 men's rations for a day, they were even better because you got tinned turkey in, you got tinned potatoes in, you got pens, writing paper, toothpaste, toothbrushes, razors, shaving soap, and 200 cigarettes for every man that it was issued. They were good. The probably the most outstanding thing in Korea, though, bar none. And I think if you ask a lot of other Korean veterans, they will tell you the same. The weather. The weather was horrendous. The first winter we were there, looking back now, you had to feel sorry for some of the guys because a lot of them were reservists, you know, aged 30 and 35. And they had to cope with the same weather that we had to cope with. And it was incredible. You couldn't touch bare metal with your hands. If you did, and you pulled your hand away, the skin had gone on your hand. And you couldn't shave because it was, you know, by the time you lathered your face, it would freeze. And you had to be very careful when you passed water because you used to pass it as quick as you could and zip yourself up sharp, and if you weren't careful you could catch yourself in the zip, which were very, very painful. But you used to have to wear the bulk of clothes to try and keep the warmth in your body, and it didn't help being surrounded inside by all steel and that. You used to have to throw petrol on the ground and light it to get vehicles to rock backwards and forwards because they would freeze to the ground. We used to get a beer ration. I think it were 2 bottles a day. You didn't always get it every day. It came up with a ration wagon. And your beer would be froze solid in a bottle. It was a Japanese beer, Asahi beer. And it would freeze solid in a bottle. It was tremendous with the cold. We used to, when we slept, we used to have a bivvy, an engine sheet, and a turret sheet, which